Previously on Target USA, an explosion of spies.
3 or 4 million.
Half that number worked for China.
Unprecedented Russian activity.
To collect information about the United States.
More than 100 countries working here.
A big, big problem.
American agents abroad.
I looked up and saw a guy looking at me with binoculars.
I'm JJ Green. Join me for The Fog of Espionage. The enemies, defectors, the tactics, U.S. agents, secrets you've never heard. Now,
from Podcast One.
Coming up in this episode of Target USA.
I parked my car thinking that there was no one with me and taking the package, left to walk to the site. It was going to be a long walk. And I'll never forget this. As I emerged from a tree line, I looked up to my right and saw a car in a parking lot, maybe 200 meters away, and a guy leaning over the car, looking at me with binoculars.
A CIA case officer overseas, on the verge of getting caught.
And pretty soon, lots of other of his friends appeared and started following me.
In what turned out to be something of a chase, there were more than a dozen people.
They knew I was operational. I was carrying a package that, if they'd detained me, could have resulted in the compromise, death, arrest of the agent.
All the things you've wanted to know but never heard about the life of an American agent overseas. Coming up on this edition of Target USA.
The National Security Podcast.
From WTOP in Washington, D.C., this is Target USA. Russia
could render huge harm to this country.
North Korea's secret missile
capable of reaching the whole of the United States.
Dangerous terrorist.
D.C. is repeatedly mentioned as someplace they would like to seek an attack.
Cyber criminals.
Decryption successful.
America has a target on its back. And on this program, we investigate the threats, the people behind them, the agencies fighting them, and the impact on you. This is Target USA,
the National Security Podcast.
I'm JJ Green. What's it really like to be a spy? James Bond is not the answer.
What James Bond did is nothing compared to what the real spies have do.
H. Keith Melton, a board member at the International Spy Museum, an intelligence historian, and a specialist in clandestine technology.
I often say that in the real world, James Bond wouldn't last 4 minutes.
This is what a day in the life of a real spy is like.
I'd wake up in the morning when it was time to go operational, and I knew I was traveling covertly, meaning in alias. So I would shower, put on Tamer's clothes, put on his watch, take his wallet, drive his car.
That's the voice of a man we only know as Tamer El-Nouri. He was undercover for the FBI, deep inside ISIS and Al-Qaeda. And he's describing what it was like to assume what's known as his legend, more commonly called an alias.
I'd drive to location. And I would have a conversation with myself, as I mentioned.
That was 2 years ago. His voice was changed to protect his identity. We've been told that protection is still necessary because he's involved in other unrelated work. His story about daily preparation is one of the few true glimpses you'll get from anyone working undercover for the U.S. government. As he pointed out, and you may already know, being a spy out here on the streets is a complex, mysterious existence requiring constant, daily preparation.
Anybody walking by me probably thought I was a crazy person because I'm speaking out loud, reciting my identifiers, my mother's maiden name, my business, locations, everything about that individual. I call that flipping the switch. And when I become that person, I turn the key to his car and I drive to the airport, and I'm never anything but that person. Whatever alias or legend I am doing, that's who I am until I arrive back home.
All of what you just heard, the day-to-day demands of men and women working undercover for the U.S. intelligence community, adds up to a very stressful life. But it's particularly stressful for CIA case officers who work overseas, undercover, like Kelton did. We spoke with him about numerous issues related to espionage and spying, particularly the stress.
Well, let me just say at the outset that even in relatively benign environments, and there really are no truly benign environments, but in a relatively non-threatening environment, where you're using your own name and living and working undercover is a challenge, right? So even if you're in your own name and you're undercover, it's difficult. It often necessitates doing two jobs, the one that you want the public to see, and your secret job, what you're really doing, your undercover work. Long hours are physically taxing. That sleep is almost always at a premium, and that's, of course, engenders strain. And then there's the strain of maintaining and supporting a cover legend in interaction with the outside world. That's people beyond those who have a strict need to know about what you're doing. In the intelligence community, we speak of need to know. And those people will be relatively few.
The process of building and maintaining a cover, as you have learned and will learn from our discussion with Kelton, is a complicated process. Very little detail about how this happens is discussed publicly. But interestingly, Target USA discovered several training films put together by the CIA's predecessor, the Office of Strategic Services, that shed some light.
Yes, to obtain intelligence on aviation production and the position of vital targets in the capital district of enemy area.
Correct. You're to set up an intelligence organization which will gather information for an SO operation. Are you set on your cover?
Not definitely. I've narrowed it down to two, either a government inspector or a chief mechanic.
Government inspector.
Kelton says no matter how you come at it, working undercover is a prickly business.
If you're working in true name, but undercover, if you're working in an alias that is using a false name, crossing borders can be extremely stressful. Being challenged by people on the street can also be very, very stressful. And having someone walk up to you who knows you in another name, and I know from experience, is certainly stressful. In a truly hostile environment, that's one where the adversary is deploying considerable resources to identify you and what you really are and what you're really doing and to track your activities, the stress can be very high. Nerves are always on edge when you're operational, when you're actually at work doing your job. But you try not to show it, of course, because then it gives away what you're doing. And officers employ techniques in the parlance of espionage tradecraft to try to protect both their true identities and the work that they're really doing. That is the operational activities they're carrying out. And the adversary at the same time is trying to divine exactly what you're doing and who you are.
According to Kelton and numerous other intelligence officials and former case officers that I've spoken to, it might seem as though the work of a spy or a case officer is glamorous. It's not. And there is an element of fear. But while that fear is palpable, it's a different kind of fear.
Fear plays a factor, but in my experience, it's not really physical fear. Yes, there are times when you're physically afraid, but they're relatively few, and very few, actually. The greatest fear I ever felt was fear of failure, especially fear I might let my organization and country down, or that I might make a mistake that would lead to the arrest or death of the agents with whom I was working. And in intelligence, and particularly at CIA, we take our responsibility to those foreigners we work with very, very seriously and do everything we can to protect them.
Wow, that's quite a significant burden to carry. And let me just maybe drill down a little bit further. Just briefly, what is, for those who don't know, a cover legend?
Well, a cover legend is an identity that one assumes to the outside world in order to protect what one is really doing. So, you're working undercover in espionage. It can be a job description that doesn't convey fully what you're doing, or it can be totally deceptive as to what you're doing. Generally, you try to present the outside world with one view as to who you are and what you are. And use that cover not only to exist and operate in an area, but to facilitate your activities, for instance, diplomatic cover right? You want to use that to facilitate your activities. So
I see. Could you take us through a stressful scenario at some stage in one day during your career when you were operational?
Sure. You know, in operations, really, the only thing you can control is preparation. You know, once you start an activity, it's a rule that anything can happen and usually does. Once you step off on an operation or an operational activity, you really have to trust in your planning and preparation for that operation, sort of combined with your experience, both that experience that you've garnered on your own and that you've learned through the experience of others, right? Vicariously or virtually through the experience of others. And knowledge of the adversary is, of course, absolutely crucial. But sometimes even the best planning is not enough. During the Cold War, I can recall an operation where I was tasked to put down a drop, a package for an agent, a package containing instructions, espionage material, money for an agent foreigner working with us.
Mark Kelton, who spent 34 years at the CIA, says an operation like this can take weeks, maybe even months to plan.
The problem was that there were people observing my activities and the activities of others at the embassy where I was working.
On the day of the operation, there was one loose end to take care of. In the intelligence world, there's something called an SDR, a surveillance detection run. It's designed to erode or flush out surveillance, and it can take hours.
I was out for an entire day ensuring I wasn't being followed before driving in my car towards the direction that I was going to put down the package.
That location had been scoped out long before and was known to Kelton, his team, and the operative the package was for.
I parked my car, thinking that there was no one with me, and taking the package, left to walk to the site. It was going to be a long walk. And I'll never forget this. As I emerged from a tree line, I looked up to my right and saw a car in a parking lot maybe 200 meters away and a guy leaning over the car looking at me with binoculars. And pretty soon, lots of other of his friends appeared and started following me.
In what turned out to be something of a chase, there were more than a dozen people after Kelton.
They knew I was operational. I was carrying a package that, if they'd detained me, could have resulted in the compromise, death, arrest of the agent. And I quickly decided to beat a retreat and returned back to the embassy with the package.
Kelton makes it sound easy. In reality, it was anything but. Over the next 60 minutes, he briskly walked, ducked, dodged, bobbed, and weaved through the streets of a city that more than 30 years later, he's still not able to name because it's classified, trying to elude the men on his heels. All the while, stuck in his head was the mantra, he could not be caught, because if he was, someone was probably going to die. That, more than 30 years later, is still the case for U.S. agents working abroad, trying to do the business of the U.S., all the while trying to save their own skin. And in the process of engaging in that kind of work, on the streets, in a hostile country, with so much at stake, there is a concern about making a mistake.
Was it a mistake? Well, certainly I didn't know that they were there. And you always learn most from mistakes. But for me, it was a hard lesson learned. In fact, we learned later that I was not being followed. What happened was, as I was driving back to the place where I was going to park my car was observed, and then the surveillance was put on me at the very end. And those things can happen. But those kind of unexpected events are the kinds of things that you learn a lot of lessons from, and you learn great respect for the adversaries that are trying to catch you. Scary for the most part for what might have happened to the agent if the operation had been compromised.
Are you able to say what region you were in at the time?
Well, I was in the Communist East at the time. I can't say exactly where I was, but I was in the Communist East. Yeah, and it was in the Cold War.
Can you speak again to the importance of having an airtight legend. You talked a little bit earlier about that, but can you speak to the importance of having one of those, an airtight legend?
Yeah, you know, the novelist Frederick Forsyth said in one of his books, a man ought to be who he claims to be. Seeming to be who one claims to be, you claim to be, is crucial to protecting the work of an intelligence officer, and particularly the agents, that is the foreign spies, if you will, who work with us. You don't want to be detected. You're trying to detect that knowledge or protect that knowledge from detection by a foreign counterintelligence service, a hostile counterintelligence service trying to track your activities and at the end identify that agent. Any inconsistency in that cover story, cover legend, will lead to increased scrutiny that being directed at the officer by that counterintelligence service, with all the risk that really entails for that officer and ultimately for the agent. So creating and maintaining a cover legend that is really a complex undertaking. First, you have to put together a plausible alias identity has to be created for the officer. A plausible identity being something that looks plausible to the outside. Then the officer must be given he's going to be given the documents that support that identity: ID cards, birth certificates, school records, military files or ranks or something of that sort, travel documents, sometimes passports, visas, plane tickets, and the like that support that legend, that alias. And finally, the officer has to learn and develop the alias identity and he must be able to defend it to hostile or innocent interrogation that could, a slip up could lead to suspicion. For instance, border crossings, it's the most obvious instance, but and daily interaction on the street. You think of how many times you're walking around on the street as a normal person that you have to produce your identity, or you're asked about who you are. That identity has to be consistent, and your story has to be consistent over time and space. And you have to be able to build on the identity, because people in normal life, their identity gains over time. Divulge more and more about yourself, but it has to be consistent. All of this is sort of painstaking work, putting all that together. And it requires a lot of hard work, but it's necessary to the success and security of an operational activity.
Mark, did you find yourself practicing your legend, for instance, reciting your identifiers or things like that?
Oh, yeah, it's a question of memorization. You know, if you were carrying a passport or something like that, you'd have to know exactly what the details were in it, or any other kind of identity, because that's the most obvious. Again, that's something you see in the movies all the time. But, it's a very real concern where somebody has a document with your name on it, your birth date, and all the rest of that. Well, you better not give the wrong birth date when they ask you, what's your birth date? So you better be studying those things. And it's a lot more than that, but that's the most obvious example.
How did you practice? Did you do it at home and by yourself, or did you go out, or just what was, how did you do that?
Yeah, do it in a safe place. You do it in your head. I mean, just over and over, making up rhymes or things that you could that would remind you of things, the name that you were using and other things. You try as much as you can to put yourself in the life of that person you're supposed to be when you're working. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of study.
Great. What do foreign and counterintelligence agents look for when they're trying to expose a spy? And what I'm getting at is, what were you up against when looking back at how foreign counterintelligence tried to get after you?
Well, first thing is a little bit about terminology. So, a spy is the person, almost invariably a foreigner, with whom a case officer, as we CIA and CIA call ourselves, whom case officer works, the case officer works. We call ourselves case officers. The other terminology is used: operations officer, handler. Handler is someone who actually directs the spy. Your spy, you're his handler. So foreign counterintelligence personnel, of course, are trying to identify you as a means to get to that spy. That spy is really the objective, right? That is the person that is doing them the most damage. That's who they're trying to get to. Mm-hmm. So the the intelligence officer becomes the medium of getting to that spy. So when you're doing that, of course, that kind of situation, protecting your cover is absolutely crucial, right? If you're actually handling a spy, protecting your cover is part and parcel of protecting that spy. But much more difficult, of course, in the digital age. Background information can be retrieved and easily checked by virtually anyone. And that makes it very, very difficult. And that can be done in real time. A digital trail we all leave, sort of credit card transactions, car rentals, internet searches, purchases, all of that can greatly assist a hostile counterintelligence officer in researching a suspect intelligence officer and then in tracking that officer.
In addition to that, there's social media.
Facebook, LinkedIn, and the like. Younger people in particular, of course, have considerable social media profiles.
Here's a perfect example of what Kelson is talking about, taken from our series, City of Secrets.
Robert Moore?
Mr. Moore, this is Jerry Fielding with People Power, an executive placement service out of New York.
Okay.
I was just calling to see if you were happy with your work.
With the work, yes.
Well, how about the money?
I found your resume on LinkedIn and...
Foreign spies are not just walking the streets. They're in your inbox, looking for people with classified and sensitive information.
Social media has made it easier for them to find.
Brian Dugan, Assistant Special Agent in Charge of Counterintelligence at the Washington Field Office of the FBI.
LinkedIn is one example. People put out there what they did in a prior life.
And here's the problem.
To any good intelligence service, those are going to be clues to find people that used to have a government job or access to a clearance at one time or another.
And who's most likely to be recruited?
Somebody who gets stuck with high bills, who has a lifestyle they can't sustain, and then you combine that with somebody who does not believe their career has gone the right way. Maybe they feel like they've been undervalued in the system.
Philip Mudd, former deputy director of the National Security Division at the FBI. So, as a record number of American citizens retire, their options are wide open, and spies know that, the human ones and the artificial ones as well.
Hello, JJ, how are you today? I want to be your friend.
There are sophisticated organizations out there that can figure out how to contact you, sometimes leaving computerized voice messages. Messages that some fall for.
Espionage has not been confined to human spying. In 2015, Chinese intelligence cyber operators stole sensitive personnel information from the Office of Personnel Management, OPM.
So here's the simple reality. Not only are there humans trying to recruit Americans to become spies, but there are technological components and people working remotely, as was simulated in this FBI video called Company Man.
As in China?
I don't think you'll be laughing when you hear the salary.
No, there's no way that I can move to China.
Think of it as a vacation.
Biometrics is another problem. Biometrics, facial recognition technology, and such things can present a real difficulty for working, particularly if you're in another name. Iris scanners at airports, border crossings. It really, really complicated the business of getting around and doing your job. And biometric passports as well should be included in that. And then there's the creation sort of large databases by government and international organizations, data aggregation. Again, this is part of instantaneous retrieval, but those databases can draw on information from across the government and as well as international organizations. And that can really make it difficult when you're trying to maintain an inconspicuous profile. Gives border guards and the like and airport security personnel virtually instant recall. So if an undercover officer's forged passport or visas pass muster with in the past with someone at an airport or border, they were good to go. Now you have to worry about the what's contained in those databases, and that has to be consistent throughout. So that's really hard to do.
Can you talk a little more about working undercover as yourself or as someone else?
So, you know, given, you know, so the difficulty, I talked a little bit about working and undercover in the internet age. It's frequently easiest and best to resort to the oldest form of espionage. That's working in the oldest and simplest form. That's working in true name. The officer doesn't have to create a legend. They just live their life as themselves. Of course, that has additional challenges. In that, you know, you remove some of the protection of an alias identity can afford in places, but at the same time, it simplifies things in that you don't have to recall a false legend and build a false cover legend, if you will. But like many things, it's sort of complex in its simplicity. Now you got to rely on extensive training and preparation instead of trying to work with a screen of an alias to work behind, and the highest professional discipline to carry out your operation successfully. But if that's what it takes, that's what we do.
I suppose my final question, and I kind of already know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask you anyway for your expert opinion. What is the number one espionage target in the world?
Well, the number one espionage target in the world is the United States, clearly. The preeminent country in the world. The world's only a superpower, and I'm not talking only about government secrets. Government secrets, of course, adversaries are trying to divine government secrets, but it goes well beyond that. It goes to industrial and trade secrets. You know, when you think about it, you know, the American government executes national security, but national security is really built on American economic power, and they are intrinsically linked, and they are both subject to targets from foreign intelligence.
Okay. Is there anything else you want to add that I haven't asked you about that you think is important?
No, but thanks very much for the opportunity to speak. I just, any opportunity to explain something to the American people about the challenges that the intelligence officers that work on their behalf face is always welcome.
Mark Kelton, a retired CIA case officer, as we conclude the third installment of our series, The Fog of Espionage. Here's what's coming up in the fourth and final episode.
The goals of spying don't change. What changes is the technology that enabled them to take place. You want secret information without the other guys knowing they've lost it, but how you get it is always going to be evolving as technology evolves.
The future of espionage and the willingness of people to become traitors.
To me, what strikes me as most overwhelming is the willingness to destroy their entire family.
That's coming up in our next episode. In the meantime, thank you as always for joining us and allowing us to spend some time with you. I'm deeply grateful for that. If you have any questions or comments about the program, send me an email at jgreen@wtop.com. That's the letter J, the color green. One word, at WhiskeyTangoOscarPapa.com. That's jgreen@wtop.com. Also, follow us on Twitter at TUSA Podcast. That's at Tango Uniform Sierra Alpha Podcast. And if you want more international and national security information, sign up for my newsletter, Inside the Skiff, at WTOP.com/alerts.
I'm J.J. Green, and this is Target USA,
the National Security Podcast.
As always, I want to offer a very big thank you again for listening to the show. We'd like to ask a small but very important favor of you. It'll only take a few minutes, and if you're one of the first people to do it, Podcast One will make it worth your time, literally. We need you to complete a short survey, because the information you give us can help make things better for the show and you as a listener. Just go to podcastone.com/survey and everything will be right there for you. That's podcastone.com/survey. The first 250 people to complete the survey will get a $10 gift certificate to Amazon.com. And two grand prize winners will be selected at random to get a $100 Amazon gift card. How about that? Free money. It's a win-win. Our shows are supported by advertisers, so filling this out will really help us cater to your needs as a listener. So please, go to podcastone.com/survey, answer some questions, and potentially make some money along the way. And thank you for being a dedicated listener. Now, stay tuned for the latest headlines from the Associated Press.